You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Trey Burney. Trey, it's good to have you here this morning. Whoops, hold it here just a second. I got to get you hooked up on the radio here. It's good to have you here this morning, Trey.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
So the way we start the show is with a huge question. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live by or some of the labels you wear to start this conversation?
Well, you're opening with a softball.
It can be as soft or as hard as you want. Right. The politicians tend to take it soft. And right.
That's a good question. Who am I? I don't know. I went through a training, sort of reflective training course recently at work, and one of the things I still find myself, I self-identify as a drummer.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I still do. I still think of myself as a drummer.
And so that was that's a big part of your life. I assume.
Yeah, I started playing drums when I was 13, 14. And totally committed myself to it for some reason. For some reason, I that was the thing I became. That was my passion. That was my obsession. So I spent many, many years learning, teaching myself, taking lessons from this person and that person, watching other people and going to clinics and like trying to figure out how this works. Uh-huh. And how broad of a language it is. And that's still kind of how I think in a lot of cases. I think of myself as part of a team as a drummer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think of myself as part of my family as a drummer. Okay, count us off. Who's gonna help us do some of this stuff?
So
the clock cycles I pay attention to for some reason. I think it's a rhythm. My wife always says that I'm a person of pattern and habit, and I certainly remain so. Large part.
That is really neat. So drummer is a metaphor for all sorts of stuff for you.
Yeah, it really is. Because of the it serves so many purposes for myself. Mm-hmm. It's like how I put things in order. It's how cathartic it can be. The experience of playing percussion is pretty physical. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it's always been something that gives you have a sense of sort of you're conjuring power from somewhere not sure exactly where it comes from sometimes.
Right. Well, I mean, when you introduced it, it sounds like it's how you launched yourself.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Because there are the launchings that we go through by simple age and passing, the grade is, but there are launchings that we take on intentionally to make us who we are. And drumming seems like a passion that you took upon yourself.
Yeah, that's a good point. And it's something that it's propelled me forward. I think that then it's a way I've interpreted the world.
Cool.
And it's a way that I've connected with other people. It's a way that I've been able to, get in front of people and do something that may or may not be worthwhile. I guess that's up to the listener.
Well,
but that's the thing.
But it's your offering. It's your gift.
Yeah.
Cool. So you also brought some music with you. What are we going to open here with?
Yeah, this first piece is by a composer named Florian Fricke. He was had a group called Popol Vuh in Germany in the 70s, late 60s through 80s. I mean, he was around for quite some time. And I was introduced to him through a friend of mine and also filmmaker Werner Herzog. Florian had worked on several of his films, and this one particular album, Lichte Tag, Lichte Nacht, and this particularly the opening track, which in English is
How Close the Way Down.
Yeah. And there's something that this particular piece made me appreciate when I tried to learn music and I wanted to learn music. I was also in a cultural place of that for some reason inspired me to want to rebel.
Right.
And halfway through this track, they switch from this minor key to a major key. And it was a point in my life where I was like, I can appreciate pretty things. And I always think about that when I hear this song. Like, it's okay to like something that's beautiful.
Right.
And appreciate it for being beautiful instead of like painful or stodgy or I don't know.
Right. But also, the first word you used was pretty things. Beautiful is often associated with the painful that you secure the beauty from, but you use pretty.
Yeah.
And it can be simple as pretty. Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Trey Burney. So, Trey, where I'd like to go next in the show is, given the life you value now, given the what's important to you now, what are some of the experiences you had to have in order to know the life you value now and know how to live it?
That's a good question. I think most of it has to do with how I view the world. I think it's taken a long time for me to give myself, I think reflecting back to what I said about that piece, myself permission to do some things. And I, for some reason, require other people to help me do that in cases. For some reason, I find myself, I'll become paralyzed by the options. So with art and with society and my community and everything, I operate best when I know the rules and the limits.
Right.
Because creativity, for me, I struggle with open-ended possibility.
Right. So my question would just almost shut you down.
Well, maybe. Levels.
No, I mean, but yeah.
When you, it would make me work harder.
The world of too many possibilities can just fry your motherboard.
So yeah, I think coming to Ithaca was, I'm originally from Eastern Tennessee, like right in the Smoky Mountains. And so is my wife. And so I still identify as an Appalachian kid in large part.
Right.
And all the baggage that comes along with that. I've spent a long time. It was not until my 30s that I think I developed a real relationship with what that place was and what it did for me. Because I spent, from 17 through my early mid-20s, like playing rock music and rebelling against everything and trying to really drive home the point that I was, or my perspectives were valuable. And that's a real struggle, and it was for me.
Okay, and what were you rebelling? Were you rebelling against the Appalachian roots, or were you rebelling against the outside perception of what Appalachian roots are?
I think all of it. If I had to stack it up, it would be a big stack of pancakes. But I think it was the Appalachian culture when I was younger.
Sure.
The political landscape, the religious landscape. Media, growing up having access to a television and seeing what happens in other places, I was like, why can't that happen here? And I want to be part of that.
Right.
And around here, nobody wants to be part of that. And it's killing me. And, I grew up on a little family farm. So it's just me and the cows and, my immediate family, which was wonderful and loving and as supportive and loving as you could have asked for when I was younger. But that kind of put in place along with this, being a drummer and being propelled by that sort of pushed me up and out of it, which was good and beneficial. And I needed for that to happen.
Right. And you needed to get out.
Yeah. I needed a distance so I could actually have a relationship and sort of better understand it.
Right. I mean, and one of the most misunderstood processes is how we paint the small, if we're from small town or rural areas, how bad we paint them, because in many ways that's what we have to do to them in order to leave them.
Right.
There are
some
very real issues there.
That's a really good point.
That's not to diminish the issues, but we paint things in a way so that we can deal with them.
We can deal with them, yeah. That's true. And I did that for quite a while. And then late 20s, went back to school, started looking around, working with organizations on digitizing old archival content for a couple of films I made in undergrad. I started to really see a different history, and it became richer and richer and richer, which was problematic too, because I was making films on voting rights and voter suppression in the South,
right,
and the state of public education through the lens of the Southern civil rights movement of the late, mid-50s and early 60s. Right. And working with professors who were writing books about schools and school systems in Southern Alabama that were not accredited, which means those kids could not go to college outside of their own state. And sort of the infrastructure that was still there. So I don't know, you develop a more mature relationship with your place.
Right. And you see the struggles as well as the lacks.
Yeah.
What they lack, as well as what they're struggling for or against.
And to be honest, when I moved to Ithaca, I had a real... It took me a couple of years to adjust because I looked around and everyone sort of agreed with me on most things. And like I was like, what do I push against? And I realized like I've spent my life pushing against things. Right. And yeah, it was a different experience for sure.
Cool, cool. And you said that it took you, the reason I asked the question about constructing your past to rebel against it was you said it took you almost into your 30s before you could find things from it.
Yeah.
And see it in more clear terms. What is the greater clarity that you're finding?
I found myself even sort of circling back to romanticizing Appalachian culture. And I have a very, I think I have a very realistic view of like what it's been through over the, mm-hmm. you know, the course mm-hmm. of, you know, Europeans coming here and settling the country. And they, one of the biggest things is that, there was survival in play for a long time. So your community was important and your neighbors were important and your land was important. And, you know, we had to help each other get through the winter, and then the industrial age came about, and it exploited parts of Appalachia. It built infrastructure that kind of went above and beyond what people were prepared for.
Sure,
and then they were the last to get the roads and things like that too. So, in that part of the country,
to get paved roads.
Yeah,
yeah, we had dirt and gravel roads forever.
I grew up on one. Now it's a state highway. Now it's crazy.
Yeah, mine started out before when my older siblings were little. It was a dirt road, and it was graveled by the time I was born. And then it's probably going to go back to dirt because there's just nothing happening in that part of Northwest Missouri.
Okay.
Yeah. So I want to take up a couple of things, but let's cut to music. You brought five pieces of music. So
I
let's
did
give you a chance to
to
play them.
This particular band I mm-hmm. went and saw in Knoxville, Tennessee. This was a quote unquote local band. They got some national reviews, but they were a band called Immortal Chorus, and they were this sort of this goth rock band that I just completely fell in love with. And the singer was so, enthralling, like this uh-huh. big, powerful voice, and he didn't care to use it in a way that was kind of theatrical and over the top. But that's what gothic music was.
Yeah,
it's just a song called View from a Desert.
Here we go.
Good. This is fun.
Realize that I was with you. Yeah.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Trey Burney. So, Trey, how has life surprised you and turned out differently than what you expected or what you thought was going to happen?
For me, certainly, if a person is a sum of their experiences, then that is something that I can see. I can definitely translate into my own life. Looking back, I remember my dad would tell me stories about all the things that he'd done in his life. And it seemed like he'd done all this stuff. How did he do all these things? Right. They're all so disparate. And like, how are they connected? And, you know, how does that happen?
Right.
And I'm looking back at myself now, even at 42, and I'm like, I've done all this stuff. Musician led to audio engineer led to working with a mastering engineer that I had a lot of respect for and learned a lot from. At that point, my wife was getting her second master's degree, and I was like, I want a grown-up job one day. How does this happen? Because, you know, recording bands until 2 a.m. is not something that I really wanted to do for forever. I'll still do it sometimes, and if appropriate. Gotta have that creative space. But then that led to going back to school, getting a degree in journalism, working in making documentary films, ended up working in cable television for a little while. Ended up here because of my wife, and she got a job at Cornell. So Knoxville, Tennessee to Washington, D.C. for a year to Ithaca. Uh-huh. And there was a job that came up at the library here at Cornell, and it was unbelievable, uncanny how specific it was to a lot of my experience. And it just seemed odd that it was a weird amalgam of things. Like, I'd be working in preservation of audiovisual content at a library where I had all of this audiovisual production experience and had worked on these films and worked with library. It was just kind so that I didn't expect that. It was one of those paths that emerged that I wasn't prepared for.
Sure. But you were completely prepared for.
Apparently. I guess I was.
But you were also a trailing spouse.
Yeah. Trailing spouse in Ithaca. I was a stay-at-home dad with my son, Eli, for two and a half years. Mm-hmm. And wouldn't have traded that time for anything in the world. So at the same time, you know, growing up in America, like, what you do is your sense of purpose. Like, what is it? Like, who am I again? I'm just a parent, which was perfectly fine. But still, there's this nagging thing of, like, what else am I supposed to be doing? Who am I now?
Right.
I'm still a drummer, right? And I held on to that.
Right. But also, and I'm wondering if there's one of the qualities, this is true of people wherever they happen to live, is some people are just more able to flow and roll with what life happens. And in some marriages, you know, one particular partner is the one who is more flexible and less, doesn't have to have things exactly in a particular way, but can make, you know, can be a kind of create a space around the other one that's more stable.
Right.
Yeah. And my particular experience of rural America was that a lot of the more traditional farm folk, not the ones that were just kind of striving to get on the commodities exchange trade, you know, products and stuff like that, but the ones that were more traditional still had that sense of community where you pitched in where you needed to be.
Oh, yeah.
And that's something which doesn't happen a lot in more urban and suburban experiences, though people have that personality. It's just not set up as quite the same kind of role.
Right.
So when you talk about being a stay-at-home dad and just taking delight in that from having had all these other experiences, I mean, I wanted to be a stay-at-home dad too. There was a little conflict over that because there were some differences of assumptions. Who was the one to create the right environment? If that's something we just, you know, didn't get worked out ahead of time.
But it's hard to prepare for everything, the way you're going to feel about something or how it's going to operate.
Oh, actually, yeah, and that's right. And you can think you can do it and not be able to do it.
Yeah.
But so what, you moved as a couple with one child to Ithaca. Mm-hmm. Did you go to college before you had kids? Or?
Yeah. We kind of timed it that way where, mm-hmm. I have a wonderful partner. She was graduating with her second master's degree in information science, and we had a baby and we moved away from home. which
major stressors all at once there.
We have friends who are like, how did you do that? And I still think if it weren't for sort of stubborn, collective stubbornness and connection as a partnership that,
collaborative purposefulness.
Yeah, right. Good. Yeah, right. We moved to DC, lived for a year and a half, and then moved to Ithaca. And, it's and then we had a daughter here, mm-hmm. 4 years ago, and her name's Rue. It's all happening so quickly. And we mentioned right before we started recording, kids grow up so quickly.
Right.
It's like I'm trying to both hold on to it and let them grow
if you came from the difference between a functional family and a non-functional family in the rural community that I grew up in is the functional families knew that their kids were supposed to grow up and either leave or take over.
Yeah.
And the non-functional families, the kids just could not really grow up, nor could they leave. Nor could they take over. Everything was complicated.
Right. That was my experience too. I have friends and family who built a house right beside their parents. They live there. I have friends who still struggle. I mean, I have friends who struggle with addiction. I have, mm-hmm. I'm talking like older friends back in Tennessee.
Right.
Some
friends here in Ithaca who struggle with addiction.
Right. And then some that, I have a good friend many good friends who are very successful and kind of did their own thing and followed their own path, even if they stayed locally,
right.
if they came somewhere else. Right. And so watching that sort of success over time and trying to keep up with them and see how they're doing is something that I still find valuable.
Yeah, yeah. And you had said earlier that you were concerned a little bit about romanticizing the past a little bit in more recent years. And in part, when you're so far from it, it is easier to kind of romanticize it. But if you stay in touch with those who have and their ups and downs, the people's ups and downs and the successes and failures, and people who succeed early and fail late, and people who fail early and succeed late, and all sorts of stuff, it just keeps life a little more grounded.
Yeah,
but totally. It's hard to stay close. How many generations were your family in Eastern Tennessee?
Oh, so on my mother's side, I want to give you an idea. My mother's side, her maiden name was Harned, and I'm from Harned's Chapel, Tennessee, which is an unincorporated, village.
Right.
That is primarily landmarked by a church called Harned's Chapel Methodist Church.
Right.
So many generations for her on her side.
Right.
Scotch, Irish, and English settlers.
Right, right, right.
My dad comes from English and Swiss German background, and he was actually born in Michigan. And when he was nine, he and his large number of siblings and their family moved from Michigan to Florida because my grandfather was a block mason and a house builder and a builder. And you
Lots
can work,
work
all year round.
There.
You can work year round, and it was booming. So. And all of the family remains in Florida, and my parents go down very frequently to see his folks or see his side of the family.
So how did your mom marry for somebody from out of town?
Well, that's a good story. So my grandmother moved to Fayetteville, North Carolina for work, and which is where Fort Bragg is.
Yep.
And my dad was he was 82nd Airborne, going through officer's candidate school. He was Green Beret and walked into Sears and, looked as he was checking out, he asked the lady out behind the counter, and it was my mom. Uh-huh. And they've been married for 45 years.
Wow.
As of December 21st.
And those are five generations of my ancestors are buried within 6 miles of each other, talking about both sides of the family in Northwest Missouri, but most of them came either down across New York, Wisconsin, and down to Missouri, or they came across Maryland, central Pennsylvania, and Ohio, which was another migration route that people took. But, the same mix, English, Scottish, Swiss, German, Interesting.
It is, yeah. So do we...
Let's cut to music.
Yeah.
And while you pick the song, I'm going to do the station ID. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. And our guest on this hour is Trey Burney.
And this is the Melvins, one of my favorite dumb, boneheaded rock bands with a song called The Hawk.
Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Trey Burney. Given your rich life, I would say the way I would characterize it, it was kind of that Appalachian kind of connection to the outside world while still living there.
Yeah.
That's almost a type in terms of rural America while still living there, but connected to a whole lot of other stuff, processing the music, processing the culture, wanting to be places you saw on the TV, but really not really wanting to just pick up and move there, but wanting some connection. So you made it to a different place. Yeah. You made it to DC, and then you made it to Ithaca. So what did you find here? How did it meet your expectations? How did it defy your expectations? How did it surprise you?
I think for me, moving here, one of the things that I was able to do, and when I moved here, I was a stay-at-home dad, stay-at-home parent, and I needed some community as an at-home parent. Sure. You need some adult to talk to. So what I did was started a father's group, and we met at Jillian's Drawers for the first couple of years. And I don't know if it's still going. The mantle got passed to different people because it's such a transitory town.
Well, it's also a transitory period of your life too.
Yeah,
I mean, the early parenting stuff is so different than the later parenting stuff, which is so different from the teenage parenting.
Right.
You know, it's.
Yeah, so it gave me the ability to, and we moved. We decided to live downtown, and that gave me and my son the ability to walk around a lot.
Uh-huh.
And so I got the feel of the town downtown. I still feel very connected to downtown. We now live up on West Hill, and we do miss being downtown in it.
Right, right.
But so I spent a couple of years, the pace felt really good. Living in suburban DC was something that we weren't quite prepared for the shock of the pace.
Which part, which suburb?
Reston, Virginia.
Oh, yeah,
my wife
worked
at the U.S. Geological Survey for a year and a half, maybe a little bit more than that. So we lived in this sort of, it was a good place to live, but getting into the district took an hour and, our son didn't like riding in a car. So that always became a barrier to doing some things. And when we came here, I heard people complain about traffic, but I was like, it's so dreamy. I think maybe we're circling back around as the city grows and dealing with its traffic issues. But the pace felt good. The size felt good. The ability to run into people you begin to meet is really wonderful. Mm-hmm. The small town thing something I didn't truly appreciate in some cases.
Right. But I didn't think you'd find that feel here.
Right.
Yeah.
But you add the level of diversity that's here, as far as like people from different parts of the country, people from different parts of the world in some cases, people with multiple perspectives on different issues. It's just, it's kind of rich.
Right.
And so that was appreciated. I really appreciated that.
Yeah. And and one of the things that people... The diversity issue is interesting because I hear white folks say it's more diverse and persons of color, no.
Yeah.
And that's partly because we're 80% white, but that can be from all over Europe or all over the U.S. And I think they're different cues. And we're 10% Asian and we're 5% Latino and 5% African American. These are rough, but they're close approximations.
Yeah.
So it's a different sort of experience. And you've come here with enough of a family, with enough work and stuff to be able to just kind of jump in
plug
to
in.
Life here, to plug in life here.
Yeah, that's I've thought a lot about the diversity issue too. When I use that word, I was thinking about being from such a monoculture place,
right? No,
originally.
But what's really funny, and I used to do this with students at Cornell, a class of 150, 200 students, and I would ask them, "Is Ithaca a small town with an urban vibe, or it is a small city with a rural vibe?" And Ithaca was whatever the opposite of whatever they were from. So if they were from a suburbs or a major metro area, it's just a small town with a little bit of an urban taste. And if they were from a more rural place, or it would be a small city with a, you know, with just a faint little bit, and then some people find it not very friendly because there are, you know, people don't always look at you here. They don't always make eye contact. It kind of depends on who and how and what.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. No, that makes a lot of sense. I see working at a university, like the student body is, one of the jokes I hear friends say is like, oh, a lot of New Jersey license plates in the Wegmans parking lot this time, like as classes roll in.
Right, right.
Or as move-in day happens and all that stuff.
That's right, yeah.
And people are going down one-way streets the wrong way and things. So you'll see, but back to the diversity thing, like that's one of the things that we really wanted for our kids. And one of the ways in which we kind of wanted to plug into that was we were zoned for BJM, which had, you know, has the largest number of you know, differently colored skinned people in the Ithaca area.
Right.
And I didn't have a problem with that. I still so my son had wonderful teachers there. The experience is wonderful. The community is wonderful. It's very family feeling. Mm-hmm. We know each other. And that's one of the ways that I wanted to keep broadening his horizons. If we'd stayed in D.C., we would have seen different things as well. But, you know, and I hear several friends who struggle with how white Ithaca is.
Right, right.
And when people talk about, you know, they minimize the disparate voices involved in representation.
Yeah. No, and yeah. But what I'm... But what's kind of interesting is because I'm hearing, I'm a generation older than you, but I'm hearing in your generation and the people who are settling down, much more of an openness to being in each other's lives and being aware of what's going on in each other's lives. There's less the privacy piece, the stodgy piece, the stuff that came. I mean, Ithaca was a really stodgy place. It was a company town, and it was a manufacturing company town because the employment, educational employment, didn't dominate the economy until after 1978, when manufacturing went belly up for a few years, and then it's well back now. But it was just it's all high tech now. It's not the same what it was back then. But it's been amazing. There was not much of a sense, nor was there, and I think still among students, there's not an expectation of community or kind of transparent vulnerability or that kind of connection stuff, which can happen. But you're a different sort of guy. You led a father's group, and so what made that possible for you?
The father's group specifically?
Yeah. And what makes that kind of connection possible for you?
I give a huge amount of credit to friends I made really quickly in the DC area. My wife, when we moved there, you know, she started going to work and I was home with Eli, and who then was a baby. And, you know, I'm bouncing him around and she's like, today you're going to put on pants and go outside. And we, you know, okay, it's like, okay, I'm going to do that. And we took a walk and we took more walks. And then we, you know, started going out and we do some grocery shopping more. Like we just started getting oriented.
Right.
But she sent me a link to a DC Metro Dads group website that existed. And every Monday, a person who became a really important figure in my life, whether he knows it now or not, I mean, still I'm in touch with him here and there, but had a dad's group and he held a play date at his house. I mean, it was open call to all of the people who would be wanting to come to his house. And we had, you know, I don't know, 15 or 20 dads who would show up at his house, and he had a great space to have all the kids. And he organized that, then would propel the week out. On Thursday, we'd go see planes take off at the national airport, things like that.
Right.
So when I came here, he said, you can do it. And it was important. It was pretty quick that I kind of made that happen here. And it was something that both connected me to the community, gave me some sounding boards as a parent. You know, sometimes it was just, you know, the kids are sitting on the floor chewing on things and we're drinking coffee and complaining. That's what it takes sometimes.
Right,
and it was important. And I made really good connections with people who I still am in touch with and adore.
So you had experience at someplace else and you brought the skill here.
Yeah. And I'm an extrovert.
Right.
So it's a little easier for me to walk up and strike up a conversation.
Right.
Or welcome somebody into a room.
Right.
In that case.
Right. And as an extrovert, you need the externals to kind of place the direction and put the emphasis And kind of limit the choices, what you were saying before, right. You get overwhelmed if it's an open, you know, whereas in...
It's true, yeah. I'm an outwardly sensing person, for sure.
So yeah. Cool. But also, was it part of your rural America roots that make that kind of relational connection important? Or is that just, I mean, do you...
Maybe.
Do you find yourself similar or different in that way to the people you run into here?
I find that's a good question. I find that, well, for one, I often and recently have been considering how people are sort of aware of themselves in ways, maybe on a deeper level.
Sure.
Like, oh, I don't really like having open conversations in public.
Right.
Or I don't like, people have a tendency to know a little bit more about themselves. And how they operate. And maybe that's just me being 42 here.
Right.
But it also, it seems a little truer. Like I know how to approach this person because they know how to talk about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it's me being 42 and having sort of an emotional vocabulary nowadays.
Right, right.
Or a sense of like what works for me.
Right.
And as an extrovert, trying not to inflict that on other people, which is...
But you didn't learn it back in Tennessee.
No. And I don't know if that was a rural urban thing or if it was just me. It took me this long to sort of become aware of those things.
Right. And what's really funny is I didn't learn it with my peers in Missouri, and I'm 18 years older than you, but I learned it with, I because my dad died and I kind of got parented by a bunch of men who were born in the 1880s, 1890s, early 1900s, who, you know, were 50 to 70, I mean, were 60 to 80 years older than I was. I was exposed to a kind of a calmness and a relationality thing that wasn't true among my peers who wanted to get out and see that wider world they saw on television, mm-hmm. and who wanted to kind of compete in the marketplace and got into a lot of, you know, big debt farming related stuff. Mm-hmm. And when the farming crisis hit in 79 to 82 or 3, they just... All of them, 50 to 70% of them lost everything.
Wow.
But the older guys would never have gotten into that kind of debt. They never would have aspired to have that kind of life, and they tended to be more relational.
Right.
And I think the people who were on that treadmill of success, they have learned relationality in the 35 years since that crash. 35-40 years since that crash. But it was very costly.
Right.
It was very, very costly. I'm rambling here a little
bit. No.
But I also, so what you're saying also confirms that what I see in some of the people in their 20s are often having a hard time connecting. They're really isolated and they don't have the skills,
right.
Or they don't feel that they have the skills. They may actually have a lot of the right intuitions, but they haven't seen them modeled in families, you know, like having a good argument that gets loud and somewhat obnoxious, but people don't storm out on each other and don't cut
right.
each other off
and
things like that, that you can just learn to do if you can just trust and lean into it, or just being direct about an addiction or a problem or a hurt, you know?
Yeah. I like that a lot. That makes sense to me. The, being able to have an argument that's productive is a healthy thing. You know, it's a very valuable thing.
Let's cut to music and,
okay.
And then we'll come back about how you take care of yourself.
Yeah.
What's up here?
So this is actually a piece of music that I made, and years ago at this point, 2010, something like that, with a group called Bright Shuttle. We pressed our own record in Knoxville on a little label, and it's called Outer Dark. It's an instrumental piece. You'll see some similarities with the first track that I played, Popol. Uh-huh. There's some definite influence there. And sort of, we wrote music that aspired to sound like Cormac McCarthy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Trey Burney. So, Trey, the way we close the show out is with a huge question. Another huge question, which is, you know, how do you take care of yourself? Physically, emotionally, intellectually, and how do you know you need to do it?
That's a really good question and a conversation I've really been having over the past couple of years.
Sure.
For myself. And with my wife.
My sense is that people in their late 30s, up to mid 40s, 50s, this is the time when you either figure it out or you don't.
I think I will. I have a lot of hope and promise.
I was being a little facetious there. We're always noodling on it, but sometimes it's more important than others.
Right. Yeah. I took, when I started at the library, I had a job, and it was really great, and it was sort of contained, and I, you know, worked by myself and was a contributor to the larger sense.
Sure.
And then a couple of, 3 years ago, I moved into a different position where I oversaw a fair amount of people, wonderful people.
Right.
But in an administrative position, the stresses are really different.
Right.
You know, being, and ultimately middle management.
Yes, you get it from below and from above.
And you do, and you manage up and you manage down. And at Cornell, it can be a high-pressure environment for a few different reasons, and one of them being sort of constant change. Mm-hmm. And watching an organization go through what it needs to go through in order to get to a place definitely can wear somebody down who's in middle management.
Right.
It can wear a lot of people down in any position. But for me, that's kind of the perspective I'm coming from. So I've spent the last couple of years really looking into self-work, self-care, trying to define that. I think that's something that's coming about in conversation in the information age jobs and the information landscape. And how do you interact with it in a way that's productive instead of overwhelming? And so I started therapy a couple of years ago. I'd been interested in doing that for some time. I went through a big Carl Jung phase in my early 20s. And the concept involved in self-work and sort of connecting to myself, maybe on a deeper sense, was something I've always been interested in. And so it was natural to be able to talk about these things on a different level. So I've been doing that, and I still cycle around, and I'll have crashes where I'm just like, I'm feeling burnt out. How do I rejuvenate myself? And I usually do through, you know, spending more time with my kids or playing more on the floor, you know, and, you know, spending more time with my wife. We just, you forget, you got to kind of reconnect. Luckily my wife's really good at and perceptive when it comes to me. She's like, you're doing that thing again. What do you need?
Right.
And I'm like, thank you. There's a reason I married you. For sure.
Yeah, it sounds like it goes both ways, but for different kinds of things.
Right. Yeah it does. She's amazing.
So how do you know? I mean, so you know when she reminds you that or tells you that things are kind of going. So what actually is it that you do physically, emotionally? I mean, you talk about sitting down and playing with the kids or playing on the floor or any kind of play activity just sets off a different part of the brain. So what are some of the other things you do?
Really, every one of the things share a common goal, which is to make space. And in times of scarcity, making space for something to have a purpose. We started going to the Unitarian Church a couple years ago, and we've been going on and off. And again, it was just a place and time to think about things, and those things in particular. A place for our kids to hear people talk about spirituality and paths and experiences that weren't us talking about them. And then, you know, therapy became a place of self-care. Even though I kind of look at the landscape of therapy sometimes as a place of privilege, like who can have, I happen to have health insurance that helps support that. And then taking time to spend with my wife, because I really enjoy it. And we're not so good at planning the things, you know, and it's with both of us working with two kids and the week goes by really fast.
And in a certain sense, you've kind of, engaged the modern lifestyle where you need some emotional support, you engage a therapist or a coach, or you need a community where these things can happen and you go to an organization or an institution. That's very different than the kind of community that would have happened in the hills and or in the mountains in eastern Tennessee. But it is another path to meeting the same needs. And when you have the resources, you can do it.
Right.
And people who live, so you can organize for bucks or you can organize for feet. And when you work with feet, then the money rarely changes hands, but the balance can shift. You know, but you seem to have found a way to deal with these things up front directly and without a lot of guilt. There's some awareness of privilege, but guilt is not a necessary. Awareness is not is helpful. Guilt is often not helpful.
Right. That's a good point. I mean, that's just making sure that these things happen where I can stop and take a walk. Like you're getting to the point, like I found that really physically moving my body is a key stress reducer.
And for me, it's 3 miles a day. I need to go off on that 3 mile walk almost every day if I can, and twice for the days that I can't go once.
Right. Good idea. So,
but it's just, that's how I've kind of stumbled into it.
Yeah.
Trey, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. This is, it's been a really good conversation.
So you want to close with one of your own pieces?
Yeah.
Introduce it.
It's actually, this was the band that I toured with a lot in my early 20s. Wonderful group of talented musicians, with a song I actually wrote the lyrics to this song, and it kind of represents a very good period of my life where touring around playing CBGBs and playing good shows and having fun and really exploring like what it would be like to be a professional musician.
And you were,
kind of was semi-pro.